I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. Steve Bannon, who was until recently a senior advisor to President Trump, made some news on Sunday night. He was interviewed by Charlie Rose on 60 Minutes talking about the tensions and conflicts between the White House and leaders of the Republican Party.
The Republican establishment is trying to nullify the 2016 election. That's a brutal fact we have to face.
The Republican establishment wants to nullify the 2016 election.
Trying to nullify the 2016 election. Okay. Absolutely.
Who?
I think Mitch McConnell and to a degree Paul Ryan. They do not want Donald Trump's populist, economic, nationalist agenda to be implemented. It's very obvious.
The GOP controls the levers of government and yet has not been able to put many legislative points on the board. The last 9 months have been largely marked by controversy and infighting. Even though the House voted some 50 times in the last few years to repeal the Affordable Care Act, it remains the law of the land. Last week, President Trump struck a deal with the Democrats, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, no less, on the debt ceiling, leaving Republicans out in the cold. Well, last week we talked about problems in the Democratic Party. Today it's the Republicans' turn. And we have two guests who have joined us. Rick Wilson joining us by Skype. He's a Republican political strategist, a media consultant, and also a columnist for the Daily Beast. Rick Wilson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is John Brabender, a semi-regular here on Radio Times. He's a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox, which is based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Worked with many Republicans, including Mike Pence during his run for governor of Indiana. John Brabender, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be back here, and hopefully we can move it from semi to regular.
That depends on how well you do during this hour, John Brabender.
Well, now the pressure is really on. So, but
anyhow, let me just give out the number to our listeners, which is 1-888-477-9499. The number to call to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Rick, let me begin with you. Is Steve Bannon right that the GOP does not want the president's agenda?
The problem for the GOP right now, I believe in the leadership particularly, is that Donald Trump doesn't really have an agenda. Donald Trump has a sort of series of reactions to things that stimulate his interest from day to day. And he will follow a shiny object for a few hours at a time, but he doesn't stay focused on anything in particular. And really his main agenda is, how does this make me look? How do I come off on in the ratings on X or Y issue? And if he really had an agenda that was consonant with the Republicans, we would be getting somewhere, I think, on a lot of these critical matters. But he's undercut them consistently on questions like the repeal of Obamacare and on things like immigration. That he always is moving the ball in ways that are only about him, not really about any sort of ideological framework that conservatives can really get their heads around.
Rick, do you see him as a Republican, the president?
No, not at all. I think the Republican Party was a flag of convenience for Donald Trump. He was a lifetime Democrat before running as the Republican nominee. I don't think he has an ideology. I don't think he believes in anything. I think he believes in Donald Trump's image and brand. I don't think he believes in anything in particular, certainly not the things that I was drawn into the Republican Party for, things like limited government and economic liberty and personal freedoms. I think those things are he may know those words, but those aren't what drive him ideologically.
John, how do you see the relationship between the GOP, especially the leadership, whether it's Mitch McConnell or Paul Ryan, and the president himself?
Well, first of all, I think you have to understand there's a big distinction also just looking at the House versus the Senate. The Senate is a little bit more moderate. They're much more likely to compromise versus the House. And so there's a lot of conflict just there alone, keeping Donald Trump out of it. I think once you add Donald Trump in the equation, you have somebody who compromised, number one, is probably not in his category. He believes either win or lose. Number two is, I think his tone, temperament, and style is particularly different than what the Senate is used to or wants to have as a relationship. And so, therefore, I think it's created this unique, perfect storm where you have three characters between Ryan, McConnell, and Trump that just are never going to be the closest of friends, and it's made it very difficult to get things done. I would disagree with Rick on one thing, though. I think Trump does have a very clear agenda. I think he articulated that agenda during the presidential race. And I think he's been pretty consistent in putting that forward as a president. It's just that he's hit a lot of roadblocks in Washington that you don't get things done there like you would normally in the boardroom. And I think it's created frustrations with everybody.
And John, just to recap, we're talking about the wall, repealing the Affordable Care Act, the travel ban. I'm thinking of all the things that candidate Trump campaigned on.
Well, and I think you got to look at two things. Yes, I've yet to see anything that Donald Trump has put forward that he did not talk about in his election. And then you have to add to that, people voted for him after he talked about those things in his election. So this is not just about Donald Trump through hypnosis getting to the White House or winning some strange game show. This is people voted for that agenda. And so, therefore, when there's criticism about that agenda, you are de facto criticizing the Americans who elected him.
Rick, do you want to weigh in on that? And then I do want to play another clip from 60 Minutes. I mean, clearly, when you look at things like tax cuts, even, quote-unquote, self-deportation, repealing the Affordable Care Act, climate denial, reducing the size and the reach of government, those were things that candidate Trump said to his supporters that he would push forward.
I think there's a difference here between the branding he used in 2016 and what he actually does and believes. I mean, the things that the White House has put forward, for the most part, have been sort of a mess. They've been sort of an ad hoc thing that some of his staff, you know, the various factions of his staff are pushing things in different directions. And I think those things aren't as considered as my friend John is. I mean, look, I think he said those things in the campaign because he was given a script and he went out and he said, we're going to go out and break off the part of the Republican base that hates the Republican Party. We're going to win the primary using that part of the base. And then we're going to go target in some states where we think these things will work, the trade message, the immigration messages, et cetera. And I think he was successful using those things as a branding thing. But I don't think Donald Trump really believes in much. I mean, if he believed in the fiscal discipline angle of this thing, he certainly threw Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan under the bus for Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer in a hot second last week. And he's, you know, now saying he's going to be working with Democrats to accomplish, you know, things, but he doesn't really have an idea what those things are beyond the branding stuff. And I think a lot of the stuff that people voted for, I completely acknowledge John's point. There were things that were popular with voters who were economically distressed and who felt like Washington had abandoned them. But, you know, I also don't think those things are really part of Donald Trump's DNA. I think he was given some branding and he chased it, but I don't think those things are part of his political soul.
Let me play one more clip just hold on there, John. One more clip from 60 Minutes. And again, this was former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon speaking to Charlie Rose for 60 Minutes. It aired on Sunday night. And this was a section where he talked about Mitch McConnell and a meeting at the White House.
Well, Mitch McConnell, when we first met him, I mean, he said, I think, in one of the first meetings in Trump Tower with the president, as we're wrapping up, he basically says, I don't want to hear any more of this drain the swamp talk. He says, I can't hire any smart people because everybody's all over them for reporting requirements and the pay, et cetera, and the scrutiny. You know, you got to back off that. The drain the swamp thing was Mitch McConnell was day one, did not want to go there, wanted us to back off.
Trump Tower, I should say, instead of the White House. John, you want to weigh in on that? And who is the swamp?
Well, the swamp is sort of the game the system that has happened in Washington by everybody from lobbyists, special interests, the even elected officials. I think there are people who have financially benefited over the largesse of U.S. government. And I think there is some truth to what Bannon is saying there, because there's sort of this underwritten belief that the presidents are renters when they come to office, but the House and Senate are the real owners. And that presidents, the most they're going to be there is 8 years and they're gone, but some of these leadership positions, they're going to be there for much, much longer. And I think that's unfortunate. I think it has created sort of this environment of keeping the status quo for those who are succeeding under this sort of Washington mess, if you will. And I think that there is some disruption being caused by Donald Trump and his agenda, and not everybody's happy about it.
Do you think, Rick Wilson, that Steve Bannon is Trump's brain, the way Karl Rove was described as Bush's brain?
You know, it's hard to read Steve Bannon. You know, part of Steve Bannon is the showman and the guy that has monetized this sort of war inside the conservative movement of the nationalist populist against the conservatives. And I think that Trump likes Bannon's scrappiness. I think Trump likes Bannon's role as a guy who will go out and, you know, say and do anything and threaten to burn down the world. But I don't think that Trump uses strategists in the way that other presidents, both Republican and Democrats, have in the past. I don't think he really listens to, you know, folks who are. I don't think you can bring Donald Trump numbers and say you shouldn't tweet in a poll, and he goes, yeah, all right, you're right. You know, this is bad. This is a bad look on me.
Right.
I think Bannon, in a lot of ways, is Trump's id rather than his brain. He sort of encourages those darker instincts in Donald Trump.
John Brabender, let me read something that Charlie Dent, as we know, a Republican from Pennsylvania, has decided not to run for re-election. This is something he said that was printed in the New York Times. He said, "Before Trump, I saw the ongoing battle between what I would call the pragmatic governing wing and the purists. That was the litmus test," talking about the Republican Party. He says, "Now, since Trump, the issue has become more or less Trump loyalty. You're either for the president or you're against the president." What do you say about that?
Well, first of all, as we know, Charlie, you know, announced that he's not running for re-election. And I will tell you, I, like a lot of Republicans, have a great deal of respect for Charlie. And so a lot of us are going to be sad to see him go. But with that said, I don't think it's fair to pin that on Donald Trump. I think that is the whole relationship of Republican versus Democrat in Washington. It's poisonous right now. Elections used to be where we were all friends other than 2 months out of every other year. Now it's the constant state of trying to beat the other side. There was also a really good poll that came out last week. It was the Wall Street Journal NBC poll, which talked about the great divide, not in Washington, but ideologically in America and particularly by geography. Ideology in cities is completely different than it is in rural areas, which is completely different than it is in suburbs, and that it's not just our politicians that have this sort of discourse. It's actually Americans now have created this great discourse of disagreement among each other, and Washington, I believe, in many ways, is just a symptom of that.
We have to take a break, Ben, and I want to put this to you, Rick Wilson, after we come back from the break, about whether you think the president is in any way responsible for this poisonous, divisive atmosphere that we're living in. We're talking with two Republican consultants about the GOP. Rick Wilson is a Republican political strategist. He's a media consultant, writes a column for the Daily Beast. John Brabender is a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox, based in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and he has worked with many Republicans, including Mike Pence, when he was running for governor of Indiana. You can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Rick Wilson and John Brabender about the state of the GOP, the Republican Party, what the future holds for them. And we've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Rick, let me go back to you. What do you make of the fact that Charlie Dent is leaving? Dave Trott just announced that he's leaving the Republican Party. Ileana Ross Layton, who's from Florida, where you are, she also leaving the Republican Party. My understanding of Dave Trott, it wasn't exactly a moderate, but nonetheless, does this tell us something?
I would hesitate to overinterpret these retirements yet. I do think it has become a more difficult place for the sort of Jack Kemp wing of the Republican Party to exist. You know, but that's not really Donald Trump's fault as much as it is the Freedom Caucus and the idea that, you know, we're going to have to all be ideologically consistent and pure across everybody. You know, Republicans used to sort of mock Democrats for saying, oh, you have one top-down ideology for every single one of your members. You all have to be anti-gun, pro-abortion, etc. Well, now we're sort of seeing the Republican Party morph itself into that same thing where the regional differences, where like Ileana Ross Layton, who lives in a district that is not a hard, deep red district, but, you know, would you rather have
a moderate Republican in a moderate district or nobody.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so I think that the internal dynamics in the House are a big factor. I'm not saying Trump isn't a factor, but I think the internal dynamics in the House are a pretty significant factor right now.
Rick, and I'll put this to you, John, as well, but do you think President Trump is energizing the Republican Party, changing the Republican Party, hurting the Republican Party? Rick?
I think, in my opinion, I think he's hurting the Republican Party. We've sort of moved away from being a party about a philosophy and ideas, and we've become a sort of party about one man and his base and his mob.
His mob meaning the people who support him?
Yes.
The basket of deplorables that Hillary Clinton talked about?
You know, that phrase, you know, here's the thing. There are folks who are, and you know, I try to be respectful of people, but there are folks who really don't, they don't want to look beyond a very narrow ideological silo now, and they're more happy about their president being constantly on the attack on CNN than they are about anything else. They're more delighted by this imaginary war with the global left than they are about trying to accomplish things. And I think he's activated a lot of stuff that in American political culture has become definitionally Trumpism, but I don't think it's necessarily what I came up with as conservatism.
John Brabender, Roger Stone said, I believe this was last summer, that the nomination of Donald Trump was a, quote, hostile takeover of the Republican Party. How do you see him influencing your party?
Yeah, and here's where I think we get into dangerous territory. Number one, when people like Roger use that type of terminology. Or I even hate when one party or the other says, you know, they won by 2% and they have a mandate. There's no such thing as a mandate in America. Nobody's looking for you to just come in and have carte blanche. But I do think there's also one important thing. Everybody keeps saying Donald Trump won by playing to the base. Donald Trump won states like Pennsylvania that Republicans hadn't won for president in like 20 years, or in Wisconsin, which they hadn't won in well over 20 years, by getting Democrat votes in addition to Republican votes. And so what we keep talking about Trump and not enough about Trump supporters. There were a lot of people who felt disenfranchised by both the Republican and Democrat Party. They felt like they were left on the economic battlefield by both parties. And it took, ironically, a billionaire to come and rally them. Probably the most important exit poll statistic that I saw was among women who were non-college educated, Donald Trump got roughly 62% of the vote. And running against the first national party woman running for president. And so that tells you that there was a lot of people out there that felt both parties were failing them. And Donald Trump, what we would see oftentimes as language that was unbecoming, they saw that as more as proof that he was going to be different and be disruptive to the system, and that's why they voted for him.
Rick, I've asked this. I've sort of lost track of how many times I've asked this question, and I think it will be asked for years ahead. We're talking about a candidate, a man who was a birther. We're talking about Donald Trump, who insulted John McCain, POW, insulted a Gold Star family, was caught on Access Hollywood tape, you know, saying derogatory and frankly disgusting things about women. How do you reconcile this kind of baggage that would undo almost any other candidate, and why it didn't undo this one?
Well, I mean, Donald Trump was a celebrity with a 1,000,000,000% name ID, and the honest fact of the matter is, Hillary Clinton was always a utterly terrible presidential candidate. She was bad at the work of being a candidate, and her campaign was a hot mess. And so the things that Trump got away with in this process were offset by the overall terrible nature of her campaign and the terrible nature of her as a campaigner. They could never make a turn and exploit the things that Donald Trump was doing wrong, because she was just an awful candidate.
But why does someone, and the McCain thing just just outraged me, to be perfectly honest.
Sure.
Why did that not discredit him? I mean, the birther thing is a whole other can of worms here, but the insult to a POW who went to war, a war that this president did not go to, that somehow that was okay.
Well, it was okay with Trump supporters because they had two things in their mind. They hated Hillary Clinton with the fire of a million suns, and they thought that Donald Trump would be the murder weapon of the Republican Party that they also hate. And that base has a built-in network now of Breitbart and Fox News and talk radio that have all decided they were going to go all in on this guy. Nothing he could say would ever be bad enough. And you know, Donald Trump joking he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue was literally the truth. Those people would have stuck with him no matter what. And the thought of economic, the economic abandonment that John correctly indicates, that's a part of it. But there was also a part of it that he had a separate media silo out there in the world that protected him the entire time. And in the quote-unquote mainstream or liberal media, however you want to phrase it, they also looked at Donald Trump as a great show and a great driver for ratings and a great thing they could monetize, and they all did. And so, you know, the continuance of the show and always moving on to the next crisis, always moving on to the next crazy statement, and never driving it, you know, no one could convert hard enough and stay on any given Trump scandal.
John, you want to weigh in on this? And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I want to say this is one where Rick and I are totally in agreement. First of all, in, you know, how did Donald Trump win with some of the things he did? You're 100% right. You have to understand he was running against Hillary Clinton. And things that we found, that the nation might have found collectively outrageous that Donald Trump said or did, were trumped or overshadowed, if you will, by the belief that Hillary Clinton was indeed dishonest. And her campaign decided to make this whole thing about white college-educated women and making Donald Trump toxic with them instead of ever having a real message, particularly an economic message, for working families. And they felt that Hillary didn't understand them. So that's sort of, I think, the first part of that. But, you know, it's again, people try to explain about some of the things Donald Trump says and how he gets away with it. I remember very distinctly when he made the McCain comment. In fact, I was one of the first to go out there and defend McCain, even though I'm not the biggest McCain fan. What he did for this country, we should all stand up and applaud him and stand behind him. And I thought, the race is over for Donald Trump once he said this. And I remember talking to a couple reporters. This happened in Iowa. They were there. They thought the race was over for Donald Trump, and it had absolutely no impact. And that's when, for the first time, we really understood that Donald Trump's candidacy was going to be completely different. People didn't like what they saw him say, but they liked the belief that this guy just calls him as he sees him, that offered a certain realism and authenticity, that they gave him a pass. And believe me, very few candidates would have ever got a pass for doing that or some of the other things.
Absolutely.
But they truly gave Donald Trump a pass. And that's where we really quickly realized he was a different candidate than we've ever seen before.
And that's John Brabender. He's a Republican consultant, with Brabender Cox, based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Rick Wilson joining us by Skype from, I believe, Florida. He's a Republican political strategist, also a media consultant, and he's a columnist for The Daily Beast. We are talking about the Republican Party, the Republican president, the Republican Congress, and what is on their legislative agenda. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Let me get Kevin from Wynwood to join our conversation. And Kevin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to add my two cents and maybe get the opinion of the group. So I think that, you know, it's not really just American politicians all the time. I think it's the people who send them there, the same people there, and then they disapprove of them to the rate of like 10%, 15% approval rating. But then you have a what, 80-85% reelection rate. And that just doesn't make sense. That math doesn't add up. It's like everybody's guy thinks, but my guy's great. And I think the gerrymandering, the money in politics, it's just a mess. It's just a mess. And you know, I'm no historian, Marty, and or whatever, but, you know, like Thomas Jefferson said, you know, there's going to be time in this republic that we're going to get the government that we deserve. And I think that's exactly where we are right now.
Well, Kevin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Rick, can you do the math for him and for all of us?
Well, look, there are a lot of factors that are why members of both parties stay in their seats until they're carried out feet first. And redistricting is a big part of it, where Republicans have in states where we control, that we have built ourselves some very good systems to redistrict and keep our seats intact. And Democrats do the same thing in states they control. And there the redistricting is a huge factor in this. It just makes certain seats less competitive unless you are a really unconventional candidate, either Republican or Democrat. We also are in a situation where money still matters a lot. And the ability to raise and spend money is still a dispositive factor in these races. And if you're an incumbent, you're going to raise money. It's just it's that simple. That system in D.C., you know, you don't have to like it. You just have to understand that it's real and it exists. And the two parties have ossified in these pretty safe seats, which is why you see the left spinning further and further to the left. And the Republican Party, you know, evolving more and more toward the Freedom Caucus, the far right side of the spectrum. So it's a melange of factors. It's this multivariate problem in terms of why people stay so long, and why people approve of their own guy is because they don't pay a ton of attention. That's the honest answer. They don't pay attention until something goes badly wrong.
Kevin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. John, let me read an email from Richard, who says, of course the Republicans are largely responsible for the divisiveness, 50 years of the Southern strategy of race baiting, trickle-down voodoo, anti-Clinton hysteria, now immigrant racism, denial of science. Please, the Republicans are very close to being flat earthers. What do you say back to Richard?
Well, I do find some of the criticism that I'm hearing a lot these days of the Republican Party kind of interesting, because if you look nationwide, I think we have the majority of governors in America. I think we have the majority of state legislatures. We have the White House, we have the Senate, and we have the U.S. House. The point being is, they're evidently, whatever the Republican Party does stand for, the majority of Americans agree with them and look at the Democrat Party, obviously, as out of step. And so, you know, what I think a lot of people have to do is understand America's different than their own neighborhood in many cases. And there's a lot of studies that show that it actually, particularly middle America, rural America, and non-college educated America are moving much more towards the Republican Party, not towards the Democrat Party. And so oftentimes there is a lot of criticism by people who don't agree with you, but what they don't understand is the majority of Americans right now seem to agree with where the Republican Party is.
Rick, let me go back to you. Senator Jeff Flake, as we know, has been targeted by the Trump administration, or certainly the president himself. I believe Steve Bannon is teaming up with the Mercer family to primary him, also to primary some of these other Republicans who haven't been sufficiently loyal to the president. What do you make of that?
Well, I think he's definitely off the Mitch McConnell Christmas card list this year.
I would say so.
He's complicating life for the Republican Senate committee tremendously, because these aren't going to be. I mean, if Steve Bannon's candidates are selected for instance, if Kelly Ward is selected against Flake, there are most observers out in Arizona look at that as a seat that Democrats have a better chance to pick up than if they're running against Flake. And I think that it complicates things, and I think it certainly it raises a lot of questions as to do I think people should be blind party loyalists to every incumbent? No, of course not. But I also think that you have to look at it in a holistic way and recognize that not every candidate, you know, Jeff Flake is not ideologically going to fit Steve Bannon's mold on every question. Mm-hmm. But is he a better fit for Arizona in the general than Kelly Ward? And I think you can make that argument all day long. So it's certainly something that that Bannon will monetize, and he will certainly spend a lot of the Mercer's money to do, and it will complicate lives for a lot of other candidates and a lot of other folks. And, you know, look, these guys have a history of since 2010, there are candidates every year that become the darling of the Tea Party or the populist movement, and most of the time they crash. And so, you know, we probably see that again this year.
You know what, Rick, we're going to keep our fingers crossed. We just lost you for a second there. But, John, let me put something to you, and we'll try to figure out what's happening with Rick's Skype. This is going back to something that Charlie Dent said about the issue being more and more about Trump loyalty, whether you're loyal to the president or you're not loyal to the president, and that becomes a litmus test. Is that good for the Republican Party?
Well, I don't think it should be necessarily loyal to the president. I think it should be loyal to the president's agenda. And if you don't agree with it, you should be able to freely disagree with it. But when you are president, you're trying to get that agenda done. When you are president, you're actually head of your own party. And there's a responsibility, if you want to get your agenda done, to try to get people in there who agree with you to get that agenda done. I mean, I think Donald Trump starts with the premise that America elected him to get his agenda done. I think I disagree often with the tone and tenor of which Donald Trump sort of prosecutes somebody when they do disagree with you or the news media. But putting that aside, I do think he's fully right and in his own right to be out there fighting every day to figure out a way to successfully pass his agenda that he was voted to do. And I think that's totally reasonable. But I want to go back to
only because we're up on a break and I don't want to interrupt you mid-answer there. So let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Brabender. He's a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're hoping to reestablish with Rick Wilson, a Republican political strategist, also a columnist for the Daily Beast. We are talking about the Republican Party. And you can join our conversation. You can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Republican consultants Rick Wilson and John Brabender about the future, the state of the GOP, the Republican Party. John, you wanted to say something right before the break.
Yeah, your caller that had a question and then Rick followed up said something remarkably important that we hear very little about, and that's the impact of redistricting and why there's so much divisiveness in Washington these days. What happens is if you're a Republican in charge of a state, you want to make a Republican district even safer. So you take Republicans away, but generally where you're taking them away is from a Democrat district, thus making that district more Democrat. And so what happens over time, these are sort of the districts become ideological anomalies. They become the far left and the far right. They get candidates from the far left and far right, and they represent people who agree with them consistently. And so Washington becomes these people that have extremely strong views one way or the other. They know they can be reelected by holding those same views, and therefore it creates a lot of gridlock in Washington. And I believe a big part of that factor is the whole idea of gerrymandering and taking advantage when there are redistricting processes. And it's not going to change in Washington till we fix that problem.
Rick, you have been, we now have you by phone, but you have been very outspoken in your criticism of the president. You did not support him. I don't believe you voted for him. You supported Evan McMullen. And the president has gone after you on Twitter, as he does with people who criticize him. Why did you not support him? And what did you see in Evan McMullen that might tell you something about the future of the GOP?
Well, I think that in terms of why I didn't support the president is, part of it was I'd done a lot of work in New York City. I had worked for Giuliani in his reelection campaign and his U.S. Senate race. And so I sort of had a little closer upfront view of Donald Trump than most people. And I didn't think Donald Trump shared any fundamental conservative beliefs or values. I didn't think that Donald Trump was a person who was serious. And look, like a lot of people, I also looked at Donald Trump as someone who could not win the election. Now, I was wrong about that. I own that every day. But my major concern was that Donald Trump wasn't a conservative and wouldn't pursue and achieve conservative objectives when he was president. And on that front, I've been exactly correct. I mean, this is a statist more than a conservative, and he's not really a Republican in the sense of being a limited government conservative. This is a guy who's expanding the power of the federal government, expanding the state. And look, it may be for things that he says he wants to do, like trade restrictions and immigration restrictions, but those aren't things that I looked at the time as being things that were ideologically successful. And I think morally, there's no argument you can make that Donald Trump is a guy who as president represents values that conservatives do and should share. I mean, this is the John McCain thing, the Access Hollywood stuff, the fact that he's a guy who has spent his entire life basically as a liberal New York Democrat flying a flag of convenience as a Republican doesn't make him a Republican. So
yeah, no, I hear you, John. I don't know if you want to add anything to that, and I have to throw in go ahead.
Well, I want to make I at least want to agree in the sense that I also did not think Donald Trump was going to win. In fact, about a year out from the first primary, I was on CNN saying, why are we even talking about Donald Trump? He's not going to win. He's a celebrity and has about as much chance as Will Ferrell does. And I was wrong because I kept looking at Donald Trump and not looking at Donald Trump voters. And once you make that transition, you start to understand it greater. But at least I wanted to throw sort of a support group there to say that there were a lot of us that got that one wrong, at least a year out.
No, fair enough. Do you think, though, and I'll put this to both of you, Rick and to John, that there could be, out of all the whatever from the 2016 election, a third party that maybe even would represent some Republican and Democratic ideas? Or do you think these two parties still have a lock on the system, Rick?
The problem with the third party remains, how do you get to 270 in a presidential race? And that's a really big difficulty. It's a really big equation. And there are groups and there are folks that are taking it more seriously than ever before. But I still think it's a very high hill to climb. And I still think it's a very difficult thing for Americans right now to break out of the sort of two-party silo that they're in. Although I think we're closer to it than we've ever been, but that mm-hmm. still doesn't mean we're going to have it emerge in 2020 or 2024. It's certainly, I mean, people are frustrated. The fastest growing group of voters in any state that keeps track of it is non-party affiliated. It is not Republican, not Democrat, it's NPA. And those NPA voters are a rising mass of people, and they tend to be the younger voters, particularly right now, tend to not be registering to either party, either the traditional parties, but they tend to be registering as independents. And that's going to change the face of American politics, I think, in 10 to 15 years.
A comment from Aaron, speaking to what you just said there, Rick, a lot of people didn't vote because they felt disenfranchised from both parties. John, you were talking about the people that did support Trump. Are we talking about then a largely white party?
Well, let's be honest. For the Republicans, that's not new to Donald Trump. Republicans generally get about 9% in most races among African Americans. But I want to go back to sort of understanding Donald Trump. Donald Trump, for all practical purposes, was a third party candidate who ran under the Republican agenda, a Republican umbrella, and therefore also got the Republican traditional vote. But I look at him very much as a third-party candidate, not a traditional Republican candidate, and therefore put this, coalition together of blue-collar Democrats and traditional Republican votes to win, and that's what it took.
But let me go back to where we started, which is Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan. Where does all of this, Rick Wilson, where does it leave the party leadership who have been batted around by this president?
Well, it leaves them in a very difficult position to achieve a legislative agenda, and it doesn't look like it's going to get much easier going forward. And I think if you're Mitch McConnell, you're Paul Ryan, you have, particularly in the House, as we all know, Paul Ryan is not leading a particularly unified House right now. He has a group of Freedom Caucus guys who are far, far, far to the right of where you know, he needs the whole overall caucus to be. And you've got, you know, a cadre of Trump guys that are you know, off on their own ideological direction. So he's got a very fractious kind of system to deal with there. And I think it would be much more helpful if we had a party with a senior leader at the top in the form of the president who could provide consistent moral and ideological and political leadership and support for the agenda. But, I mean, I think none of them believe that that's ever going to happen. I think they've largely checked out on Donald Trump as a full partner in an ideological and political, you know, movement question. Right? They're not really waking up in the morning going, okay, let's get the president and he can close this deal anymore. That's the image of Trump as the deal closer for congressional agenda items is way in the rearview mirror.
John, does that hurt the party?
Well, it could in the short term, but I think not only do they look at the door is shut, I think the president looks at it that he no longer has dependable partners in the leadership, and therefore we see him now reaching out to the other side of the aisle to try to cut deals directly. And we also saw last week a story, or maybe this week it was, that the Freedom Caucus is looking already for sort of a champion to come in to be Speaker of the House. And a lot of people know this. You do not have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker of the House, and they're looking outside the membership. And so it's causing even more of a fracture sort of House. And so, therefore, I think Trump is looking at this saying, hey, I'm going to get my agenda done one way or another. I'm hoping these guys are with me. But if not, if I have to make strange bedfellows, I'm willing to do it.
In a sense, what happened to Boehner will happen to Ryan, John?
I think there is that possibility. I will say this. I think Ryan has probably been more open-minded and more available to some of those that are in the more reform side of the House. But I think there still is a lot of growing frustration that they're not getting their agenda done. And that, for the Republicans not to repeal Obamacare, which was the centerpiece of what we've been running on, which seems like now for about 8 years, you know, is an absurdity considering that we have the House, the Senate, and the White House.
Let me get Mary to join.
I think John's absolutely right. I think John's right on that. The fact that we've made certain major promises to Republican voters of all parts of the spectrum and just can't get off the dime now, it's everybody's fault at this point. And I think that's a big issue one of the reasons why the party why the fracture is growing. You know, Trump is a factor, but not the singular factor in that. This feeling of being stuck and of not moving forward on major promises is definitely raising the tension level inside the caucus and with Republican voters. I think John's exactly right on that
one. Let me see what Mary has to say. Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I just, as someone, you know, I'm a middle-aged woman. I consider myself on the conservative side, but sometimes I break and go Democrat, especially in local elections. And one thing that I don't think anybody is bringing up is that, you know, Donald Trump, early in his election, gave a list of who he was going to put in the Supreme Court if he had a chance. And to me, every time he did something stupid, you know, I kept thinking of if Hillary Clinton became president, she would get to get at least one, maybe three Supreme Court justices. And that was what kept me going back to him. I mean, I would have had Ben Carson. That was my first choice, then Marco Rubio. But every single time, all I could think about was the Supreme Court.
Oh, that's fascinating. Rick, you want to weigh in on that?
I'm sure John has seen the same thing. I saw that in any number of focus groups and interviews with voters in 2016 of the overwhelming prevalence in voters who were thinking it through a little bit was Hillary's choices for Supreme Court. You know, the overall policy direction she would take the country was amorphous in their minds, but they knew she would name people to the Supreme Court they would hate for generations. And it is a big deal. And I will give the president full marks for accepting the recommendations of the Federalist Society and Mitch McConnell and picking Gorsuch, because it was a great call for conservatives. And conservatives, you know, I'm a critic of the president, but that was a call that I'm glad was made early, And I'm glad it was the right call to name a serious substantive jurist to the court on the conservative side. You know, that is something that Republicans really wanted. And that is something one thing they have gotten out of this administration. And I'll give them full credit for that.
John, we have a number of people saying, yeah, he won through the Electoral College, but Hillary Clinton received something like 3 million more votes. So the criticism of her doesn't resonate with them. She won the quote unquote popular vote.
But you got to understand, when you run a campaign, you are running that campaign based upon the rules on the table. You're putting resources, everything based upon the rules on the table. And therefore, you know, the real campaign came down to a small number of states. And that's just the reality of how the Electoral College votes. I doubt Donald Trump ran a single ad in states like California. But I want to say this, you know, going back to sort of this thing on the Supreme Court, Donald Trump's campaign did one thing that probably won the election for them. They didn't want to spend the whole time talking about conservative issues. They wanted to move to more populist issues, but they had to calm down the conservatives that he was going to be conservative enough. They did two things. They put that list out of who they would be their nominees for the Supreme Court that they would take. And second of all, he picked Mike Pence as his running mate. Immediately, the conservatives said, that's good enough for us. This is what we care about. We're good. Let's move on. And it let Donald Trump's campaign move on to the issues that they wanted to talk about.
And we should say that you worked with Mike Pence in his run for governor of Indiana. Rick, let me put to you the question I put to John. But do you see the Republican Party as a white party? And is that a danger in that we are becoming increasingly a more diverse country?
Well, I mean, look, as John correctly noted, you know, it's not a secret that Republicans have for a very long time had difficulty in achieving minority voting support. It's just a fundamental. And the party right now, I think, is in a dangerous position because, you know, it was one thing when it was kind of a sense of benign neglect and we just don't get along on big policy issues. I think that if we're not very careful as a party, the president's mishandling of things like Charlottesville is going to cause a rift where it becomes perceived that the Republican Party is actively hostile to minorities. And I think that is an electoral poison pill that could be very, very deadly in the long term. And it's something that responsible leaders in the party need to address quickly, and they need to purge out from the party any idea that these alt-right guys and these white supremacists and neo-Nazis are welcome in our party. And Republican presidents going back, you know, in this century, certainly going back to Eisenhower, have been very strict and very clear about these messages that we don't accept that. We don't tolerate that. That's not part of the game plan and not part of our ideological belief system. But right now, you know, even though Trump has come out and said the right words after, you know, four or five tries at the whole thing, if we become associated with the alt-right and the rising tide of overtly racist political movements, and those folks try to latch on to the Republican Party, I think it's a real problem for us down the line. And I think if we don't fix it, we deserve that problem.
We have to end on that note. Rick Wilson, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Republican political strategist, a media consultant, and a columnist for The Daily Beast, John Brabender, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And he's a Republican consultant with Brabender Cox, again based in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. We appreciate all those comments and calls to the program. Bob Alls, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us.